The following Dharma talk was given by Jodi Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, Brooklyn, and welcome to all of you who are here for the first time. Nice to have you, so many this morning. I'd like to start off with a reading from the dedication we did this morning for the women ancestors after reciting their names. And to the generations of realized women whose practice and teachings bring us the Dharma here and now. So this week I was carrying over from last week, which was Bodhi Day, celebrating the enlightenment of Shakyamuni Buddha. I was still kind of filled with ancestors, contemplating ancestors both in my genetic lineage and my dharmic lineage. And just how their wisdom of their actions is what is carried through generation to generation. And on Bodhi Day, I spoke some words from Myotai Sensei, where she says, "The celebration and commemoration of the enlightenment of Siddhartha Gautama is wonderful that we can celebrate that day, where the possibility of not just spinning with confusion, reactivity, and fathomless separation is celebrated. That amid the spinning world, a profound stillness is possible. And as Myotai implores us, that we continue endlessly to find our way together to move this Bodhi Day from calendar and story to breath, bloodstream, and I would say, and illuminate our hearts and minds." And I spoke about how we don't do anything alone, that when we look deeply into our life, we're supported by the seen and the unseen. Many ancestors of ours, if you're in the Dharma, if you're here today, someone in your lineage, there's something that got printed, that passed on, that brings you here today. And how the Buddha, I called it 20 feet from stardom, had all these people behind him where he might not have made it to Buddhahood because he was starving to death and somebody fed him. Because in the beginning he was born and his adopted mother took care of him and fed him and brought him up. His wife, Yasodhara, allowed him to go seeking, supported him. And then when he touched the earth, Prithvi, the mothering aspect, the mothering earth, met his touch and was able to, like we're met in our taking our Bodhi seat, and those aspects of the Mara mind, that devil mind of ours that wants to turn us away from what we know is good, was turned away. Those arrows that were fired were turned to flowers. So I wanted to pick up this ancestor connection as our beacon of study, and I do it. It's that we're not practicing alone, that not in the darkest pit of hell, not in the brightest state of bliss, are we alone. And when we know this, and when we sense this, our natural response is to bring forth our ancestors and look at them in veneration. We can bow, we can meet them, which is none other than meeting ourselves. And of course, we all know that some things from our ancestors, some vows made were not so good vows. We all have that too. And it's not all that. And sometimes those vows that were not so good, if somebody made a vow to alcohol, say, and that vow got passed on, perhaps we are the generation that makes a shift. And we can appreciate their pain and their suffering and what happened, their wounds that may have led them to have such a life. That's as we go through practice, we begin to understand karma and these vast connections, this vast web, more and more. And it opens our heart. The places where we felt broken can break our heart further and further open into a more loving capacity, a compassionate capacity. So I wanted to bring up a Buddha ancestor. She's the 49th one that we chanted today, Otagaki Rengetsu, who I have a particular deep relationship to. She's from the women's lineage, and I know of her first through her brilliant poetry and her pottery. So since today's an art day, in a sense, we're having art presentations, I thought this would be good to tell you about Rengetsu and her devotion to the Dharma and to the arts. And also just to mention, as I was talking to Terry, suddenly her name just slipped through my mind. What's her name? Nikki Giovanni passed away, a great poet that we lost, a very important ancestor in our life. So I offer this to her, remembering her. So the dedication indicates we're receiving teachings continuously from our ancestors, from all the generations of realized women whose practice and teachings bring us the Dharma here and now. That they are bringing us the Dharma here and now. All of them, and many people, many lives that have been forgotten, left unsung and unseen, who have brought the teachings and allowed us to be here today, that we bow and we meet them. Without the Buddha's realization down to the present moment, none of us would be sitting here together today. Can you believe it? We would not have a temple. It's all from this realization that has come down to us all these centuries that is alive here in you, in practice. This way, this temple to dedicate to refining our lives, to see there's a path to end suffering that comes right from the Buddha's realization, and that all these generations down to this place right here. And I went through many of the women ancestors in thinking about who and when I wanted to speak about. And of course, she was the obvious one, and I will elucidate the connection for you. And so many of the women's stories are very double-edged. They speak of beautiful women who scarred themselves in order to be allowed into practice centers. Women who waited all their lives for their husbands to die so they could do what they wanted to do from the beginning. Even the really powerful ones have elements that give us pause. This one killed her husband. That one went mad after losing everyone she loved. This one was a prostitute. That one, according to herself, became a stick of dry wood, completely uninterested in having anything to do with sense pleasures. And then I found Rengetsu herself was uncommonly beautiful, and she was called the woman who was too pretty to believe. And throughout her life, she was constantly being accosted by men, even after she became a nun. The story goes that she went so far as to pull out her front teeth to make herself less attractive. But even that didn't work. So Rengetsu continued to be widely known as the beautiful nun in Kyoto throughout her life. So Rengetsu, in one sense, she was the one who nudged me to explore Buddha Dharma and land in Zen training. She mainly did clay work and painting, and she was an incredible vast support in my life when I was particularly overfilled, overwhelmed with grief from loss, offering teachings on right view and how to massage the heart with moving meditation, which she did on the potter's wheel and in her painting. How did I meet her? Well, when I was a little girl, 7 or 8, let's say, I went on a class trip to the Philadelphia Art Museum, and a potter came out and took a lump of clay. Punk, that's how it gets its name, throwing. That's the first gesture. You throw it. And out of that lump came this vessel, this huge vessel. And I was just, it hit me right in my solar plexus. I could not believe this magic that happened before me, seeing this pot form. And at that moment, I just had this very visceral, like, you know, when you get that experience, I'm going to do that. I will be doing that. And I went home and I told my mother, and she heard me. And so she signed me up for a pottery class, and I just kept going, you know, kept going. And I'm pretty young. And so when I did it through high school, and then I came time when I was graduating, and I heard about an apprenticeship. And I knew of the potter, Maria Martinez, from the San Ildefonso Potters in New Mexico, and this black pottery, which I just love this black pottery, because I had an affinity for drawing in darkness and really exploring darkness. And my mother said, well, they weren't so keen on this. Since you can, why don't you try college in Pennsylvania, where I grew up? And if you don't like it, then we can look into this apprenticeship thing. And I said, okay. But I couldn't understand declaring myself as an art major, because isn't everybody an artist? I mean, why would you declare yourself an art major? It seemed, didn't go together. So I started off in environmental biology. I thought that was the closest to clay I could get. Made sure they had a ceramics department. And then very soon I found out why I wanted to study art and object making and the history of our desire to create beauty, to bring something to birth that hasn't been here before. And so I followed that. And my first teacher was very vessel-oriented. I started to learn the wheel in earnest. Mostly I was a hand builder, and I really started, I want to learn this potter's wheel, because it takes a while to learn to center. If you've ever worked on it, you don't just sit down and make a magic show. It's a lot of slop and piles of repetition. It's very much like Zazen. You have to meet yourself, and in your mind you see all these beautiful pots with glazes, and you're just working with a bunch of thing that's wobbling all over the place. It gets very real. Most people don't make it through wedging. You have to align your clay first. And I think most of the people dropped out of the class just from wedging, because they didn't get onto the wheel yet. And my teacher was brilliant. He was just, stay at the wedging table. So you have to deal with yourself and all the things you dream about and all the fantasies of where you're going and what you want to be. And then you just have this clay that is just going all over the place. But he was very vessel-oriented. He had a strong European formalism, so there was a very proportioned feet to the body, to the neck, which drove me a little batty. I didn't know any different, but I followed what he was teaching and even made us take a ruler out at some point to measure proportions. Okay. My pots were always crooked, centered after a while, but crooked, lumpy. And then I was invited to a museum with my friend who was, had a friend who was a curator of ceramics. And they brought out a few tea poles made from great Chinese, Japanese, and Korean potters, Chojiro, Kenzan. Do you need a chair?
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. I just want you to make yourself comfortable. You have to sit with your legs out. It's okay. And bizenware, shigaraki, these were all naturally fired pots. No glazes, just from the flame and from ashes. And they brought out several of these bowls, which I could actually hold. And they were very simple, very austere, very, and deeply centered and asymmetrical. And I was like, this is where it's at. Like, what is happening here? I never felt anything like it. Some of them even had rocks protruding and crust left from firings, fingerprints, seashell impressions, like it was pulled right out of the earth. In contrast to his work, which I'm not saying good or bad, but it was glazed and it was stiff and very formal and had its own beauty. And then he brought out this very unique lumpy bowl with calligraphy scratched into it, thrown very roughly with a milky cream glaze. And it was repaired, it was broken, and is repaired with a thin gold line, which is called kintsugi. It's a repairing and a restoring of that which is broken to make it even more beautiful. So it's a state of mind practice of beautifying what has been broken. I found that out later. And again, this bowl was very different from the rest, and I just shouted out to him, "Who let this happen?" "Who let this happen?" He said, "It's the bowl of the Buddhist nun, Rengetsu, a skilled potter and painter and calligrapher, regarded to be one of the greatest Japanese poets and painters of the 19th century in Japan. I set out to find more about her life. There wasn't a lot at that time, but I found some broad brushstrokes of her path. So she was born Otagaki Nabu, February 10th, 1791, in the pleasure quarters in Japan. 10 days after she was born, she was adopted by a practitioner who worked at a Pure Land temple, important Pure Land temple in Kyoto. And at 7 years ago, she was sent to this castle, a training place where they did training, and she learned about poetry, calligraphy, jiu-jitsu, martial arts. She was an expert Go player. She could beat anyone in Go. And she could calm wild horses. She could perform tea ceremony, disarm any drunkard with a jiu-jitsu move. And later, there was glimpses, she taught martial arts to a few nuns. I love that. And it was said that more than once, she just took the clothing right off her back and gave it to a beggar. At 15, she returned to Kyoto and was married off to a young samurai with whom she had a son and two daughters. at 15. All of them died as infants, and her husband soon died as well. So can you imagine? She's not even 20, and she's lost three children and a husband. And then she had a 4-year second marriage, which ended in widowhood. Seems that she had a daughter from that marriage who also did not survive. And she was also known to be extremely kind, perhaps because she experienced so much heartbreak. Here's one of her poems. "The impermanence of this floating world, I feel over and over. It is hardest to be the one left behind." So clearly we see that her personal life was a relentless teaching on impermanence. Dogen always said, implore us to see the impermanence directly in front of our eyes, always. Any person, anything, everything, all phenomena, impermanent. For her, it was this close. Sometimes it's in a faraway land. Ah, I know about impermanence. Of course, pull anyone off the street. I can go out there. Hey, do you know about impermanence? Yeah. But then it moves closer and closer and closer till it's in our own home. At the age of 33, she made a decision to become an ordained Buddhist nun, perhaps a heartfelt effort to make sense of all this impermanence. She cut her hair off, and she decided, I want to be free from samsara, free of suffering. And she took the name, she was given the name Rengetsu, lotus moon. Getsu is moon. Ren is lotus, lotus moon. And after she was ordained, she settled into a hermitage on the ground of her adoptive father's temple. He died 9 years later, as well as her two remaining children. Didn't stop, which resulted in her being evicted, because she had no ties then to the temple, so she was evicted. She's 33. And she was forced to leave her hermitage. And I can imagine after so many losses, that's a pretty hard hit. And without a place to live and without a means of support, she decided to make pottery inscribed with her poems, create calligraphy and drawings on scrolls. And pottery would again serve as that moving meditation to soothe the pain in her heart, which it does. So it was more simply a way of making a living, but it was a practice, a way to make sense of her life, make her enlightened effort tangible. And she went off to produce more than 50,000 pieces of work. It's not uncommon to go to a flea market and buy a lumpy pot and get a Rengetsu. They were just, they're circulating all over. And she was ordained in the Pure Land tradition, and she studied and integrated Zen and Shingon Buddhism into her practice. But her poetry especially had leanings towards Zen teachings of self-inquiry, usually not about going to some paradise like the Pure Land, right? So it wasn't like she was going to end up in some Pure Land. It was pretty much nitty-gritty, the right here now. Her poems, it said, lean toward awakening moment to moment in the here and now rather than visions of paradise. Rengetsu's pottery was plain and lonely. Lonely in the sense of, if you know of wabi-sabi, just like had a kind of poverty to it, like well-worn slippers or something that you've used a lot. That kind of aloneness. She writes, From morning, I pass the day working with clay. In the evening, I give thanks to Buddha. Nothing more to think about. And her brush strokes were called grass script. So I remember one day being at the monastery after a windstorm, and we have a lot of white pine up there, and the branches came down and scattered all over, little pieces, big branches. And I was like, oh, I just got a letter from Rengetsu. It looked just like her handwriting. It was like pine branches like that, choo, 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 down her pot. And her pottery became really popular. In fact, she was flooded with orders, so she began to move to avoid the crush of orders of customers. She had a very few possessions. They all fit into a couple little boxes, and she was always ready to change residence. So she had a kind of, maybe you could call it an inability or a desire to not settle down too much in one place because of this impermanence that she always experienced. She once likened herself to a drifting cloud blown by a fierce wind. Eventually, in her maturation, she developed ninjutsu, which is a state of mind. It's not a technique, where it's rather a presence that's not detected. A presence that's not detected. And when she was a martial artist, she would try and disarm someone with presence before she had to make any kind of move on them. That's how developed she was. We can do that too. We can disarm people with presence before we make too much of a move. It's a state of mind. My teacher had that, Daito Roshi. I think I've spoken about that before, where he could show up next to you and you don't know how he got there. It was frightening, because he'd say something like, "Good morning, Hoja." Like, oh my God, I don't know how he got there. He just had a state of mind that was extremely present and silent as it moved. She also lived a life of service, and she would assist struggling artists inscribing her poems on their work to make it easier for them to sell. Even to people who made fakes of her work, she gave them a few genuine pieces to help them do a better job at copying her. Here's a poem that I will give you a sense of her true colors. She's maybe in her 40s. I know it's naughty. I love this one. I know it's naughty for a nun, but I asked the girls gathering chestnuts to fetch me some sake from the village. I like that. And one day a thief came to her place, and she said, "There's nothing here of much value. You can take what you want. You must be starving to be so desperate. Sit down and I'll make you a cup of tea." So she makes the thief a cup of tea, rice tea, and then she writes, "If the mountain bandit came to my place to steal away golden oak leaves, he struck it rich." A momentous event in Rengetsu's life at age 72, in the 1860s, she approached a high-ranking general, Seigo Takamori, during Japan's brief civil war after the Meiji Restoration. They were trying to get rid of the shogunate, the shoguns. And she apparently appeared on a bridge and stuck a note in the general's hand, if you can imagine this 72-year-old nun on the bridge, slips a note to the general in the middle of a civil war fighting, and he took a look at the message, and it said, "To those who strike and to those who are struck, keep in your heart that we are all people of the same noble land." So this general took the message to heart and negotiated a peace settlement with the shogunate, ending the war, saving hundreds of thousands of lives. And Rigetsu became known as the Buddhist nun who saved Japan. Wow. 72 years old. Activism. Slipping a note to a general. Never know. I told people, I wrote to our incoming president for if I could have audience with him. I have no idea what I would do or say. I just asked. Just, I don't know. Maybe I could just slip a note in his hand. I don't know. Upon turning age 77, she writes, another year has arrived. If I die, it is fine. If I live, it is fine. It is fine all the same. I may go, but spring comes once again. So I'll fast forward now to 1990 and this encounter with Rengetsu Bowl that made a deep impression. And I began searching for her poems, and I began to inscribe words inside my pots and outside my pots and on paintings. And I began to mostly wonder, what is this Buddha Dharma that she was studying? I knew not much about it. What did she see about her self nature, about the nature of all phenomena? What she see about the questions of what is life, what is death, reality? That was lightness and darkness throwing through her poems, I saw. I learned Zazen, and I found an apprenticeship with Toshiko Takaezu. She had a recent exhibit at the Noguchi Museum. And lo and behold, there was a placard that had an inscription and a dedication to Rengetsu. I worked with her, and I never knew that she knew Rengetsu too. So I wondered. I changed residence a few times, began to teach ceramics and painting in colleges, maintained a studio and a stained glass business. And eventually, through some very synchronistic events, I landed at the doors of Zen Mountain Monastery in the Catskills. I was 31 years old, and I met Abbot John Daido Luri, who was an artist priest himself. And he placed art practice, which was considered and held up in this tradition that you're in right now, as a viable path of self-realization and liberation from false views. He taught how to see with the unconditioned eye. He gave me my first koan, how do you throw a square pot on a spinning wheel? Still working with that one. But wow, did I strike it rich. Zen training full of art practice. I had no idea what I was about to enter, yet I had faith so far in my direct experience that I was receiving through Zazen. My world was turning upside down and inside out in what I would consider difficult yet positive ways, like what needed to happen, but difficult. And I entered, after I developed a home practice, and I did a few retreats where I could test Daido as a teacher. One was the wilderness retreat. I thought he took people out into the wilderness for 10 days, and I thought, that's the great equalizer. No robes, no incense, no bells, just earth, water, canoes, rain, weather, mosquitoes. How is he? He passed my test. And I met the people that were around him, which is important to see what are the people like around a teacher. How are they? And I entered a year of residential training in 1990, and I asked Dido to teach me. And I hadn't left since that time. A lot of people ask me, did you want to be a monastic? I knew nothing about being monastic. I didn't even want to go there. Actually, somebody signed me up for my first retreat as a birthday present. So it wasn't on my own, like, yeah, I want to go to Zen Mountain Monastery. No, I liked my studio space, and I liked to sit down by myself. But I went, and I've said many times, when I heard the Dharma, a conversion took place, like something where you resonate so deeply and you're like, oh my God, and you can't turn back. You heard something and you just can't turn back. You know it's true. And so that accumulated and happened. And then, very shortly after I was there, in that same year, they invited this Zenga painting lecturer named John Stevens. Some of you may know of his books. He's written many books on Zen and art. Lust for Enlightenment was one of his first books. And he started to show all these slides of brush paintings and ink paintings. And he was showing, Zen is called the artless arts of Zen. And I was in heaven meeting these ancestors who were originally entered the monastery were the poets and painters who became priests because they had these questions about life and death and what was reality, what was true. And then I heard Bodhidharma's words that Dido would often say. Zen is a special transmission outside the scriptures. Doesn't rely on words and letters. It's a direct pointing to the human mind and the realization of Buddhahood. So it didn't have anything to do with intellect, how much you could read or write, schooling, no schooling. It was a direct pointing to the human mind, to the state of consciousness through practice. And I thought, that's the heart of art. A direct pointing to the human mind, no dependence on words and letters, even though they may be used. The realization of our true nature. And in that showing of his slides, lo and behold, up pop slides of Rengetsu's tea bowls and her painting. So, of course, when there was a break, I ran up to him like a maniac. And I said, do you know about the Buddhist nun Rengetsu? And he took me in. He's like a hawk. He reminds me of a hawk. He has a sharp nose and these very beady black eyes. He's an Aikido guy, too. So he's like, boom. He's like very centered, and he always stood very strong. And he took me in, and he said, she is the most remarkable woman and inspirational person I have ever met. And John and I are still in touch. He sent me all her books, his books. He's organized shows about her. And so I wrote him this week, and I said, I'm giving a talk on Rengetsu. I have a couple questions. And this is what he wrote me back then. This is the end of an article and a little bit about his connection to her. Okay, we're doing okay. Rengetsu was on her own path with her own ideas, her own experiences, and her own techniques. She remained independent, in many ways revolutionary. In Japanese culture, there's a fundamental belief that art is the mother of religion. Utsukushi, beautiful beauty, is a form that lifts your spirit, makes an impression on your soul, and warms your heart. True beauty is pure in objects and human beings. In Buddhist iconography, it is the tenet that one can attain enlightenment at a single glance of a beautiful image. A beautiful image itself has achieved the virtue of a Buddha. There is a liberation from the dichotomy between viewer and viewed, actor and action. The quality that is most admirable and inspiring to me about Rengetsu is that her character transcends gender. She has such flexibility and elegance, strength and determination. She has a balance of energies, let's call it masculine and feminine. During one of the most challenging eras in modern history, she held her own physically, physiologically, artistically, and spiritually. In fact, she was strong as anyone of that time. This tiny Buddhist nun had such an impact on society in all the important realms: martial arts, literary, calligraphy, craftsmanship, charity, and statesmanship. She seamlessly moved through all these rooms. I found her art to be consciousness-raising, refreshing, peaceful to contemplate, and capable of lifting one's spirit. And then he writes, on a personal note, while working on Lotus Moon, Art and Poetry of Buddhist Nun Atagaki Rengetsu catalog, I fell deathly ill. Uterine cancer, septic blood infection, diabetic coma, and a host of other serious ailments. I had two near-death experiences. This is John. I was in and out of the hospital. While lying in my hospital bed, I asked my wife to bring me a Rengetsu tea bowl to hold. Kneading the clay was the way Rengetsu meditated. She silently reciting prayers and mantras. When I held the bowl, I could feel she had kneaded the clay and see her fingerprints. It was a kind of heart-to-heart transmission. There was a natural rhythm to how the piece was formed. It felt like it had emerged, not been made. There was no break in concentration. The creation was seamless. There was no projection of the artist's ego trying to make a statement. I liked to hold the tea bowl quietly for a time to absorb its beauty. The experience was purifying. I felt reassured that everything would be all right. I realized there was a beauty to Rengetsu's pottery. Also, the bowl had a subtle buzz to it, as if it was sentient. Caressing the bowl was reassuring. I felt its kindness and its healing power. I did, in fact, get better. And so he found me two of her tea bowls and a teapot. And of course, one of them had kintsugi, was repaired. Actually, what he told me was, he says, drink the tea and feel her heart. Use it. I had it up on the shelf, and he's like, use it. And then I was taking one out, and I dropped it, and it broke. I was like, oh my God, I broke my Rengetsu tea bowl. And I could sort of hear her laughing and saying, yay, good job, you broke it. So I learned kintsugi, and I started to learn how to repair and make more beautiful things that are broken. And I realized, well, I think that's Zen practice, is learning to repair with gold, the gold of our sorrows, the gold of our emotional afflictions, and see it's always broken and never been broken, all at once. So I fixed her bowl. Not so well. But anyway, I take her marvelous to heart. So that's our ancestors. There's a piece I read in Hidden Darkness, a chapter on ancestors by Joan Halifax, and I want to share a piece by Birago Diop. And also, my good friend, who writes a lot about art, is James Baldwin. Terry and I were speaking about him this morning. And he says, the artist is present to correct the delusions to which we fall prey in our attempts to avoid knowing so much. It is for this reason, he says, that all societies have battled with the incorrigible disturber of the peace, the artist. I doubt that future societies will get on without artists any better. It is absolutely inevitable that when a tradition has been evolved, whatever the tradition is, the people in general will suppose it to have existed from before the beginning of time and will be most unwilling and indeed unable to conceive of any changes in it. They do not know how they will live within those traditions that have given them identity. So in this part by Birago Diop, who's a Senegalese poet and storyteller, I'll leave you with his words. I think I'm close. We think that the ancestors are behind us, but they are actually those who go before us. They are a vanguard, a spirit wave that pulls us along. When the Hopi enter the Kiva, they go into the body of the past to ensure the future. We too must seek this initiation, search the rich darkness of the past that is hidden by time to establish the individual firmly in the continuum of all existence, to see ourselves as part of the continuous body of interconnecting, interdepending, and interpenetrating members. Past, present, and future is one of the functions of Buddhist training and meditation practice. And until we give birth to our ancestors, Earth cannot be redeemed from its suffering. To exclude any species from the continuum of existence, either consciously or unconsciously, is to deny a part of ourselves. Those who are dead are never gone. They are here in the thickening shadow. The dead are not under the earth. They are in the tree that rustles. They are in the wood that groans. They are in the water that sleeps. They are in the hut. They are in the crowd. The dead are not dead. Those who are dead are never gone. They are in the breast of the woman. They are in the child who is wailing and in the firebrand that flames. The dead are not under the earth. They are in the fire that is dying. They are in the grasses that weep. They are in the whimpering rocks. They are in the forest. They are in the house. The dead are not dead. In John's inscription that he sent me for his book, he wrote, "Let's walk in the light of the lotus moon." Rengetsu remained productive until the end of her life, painting 2 days before she died. I wrote in my proxy to please have a paintbrush and paper by my bedside in case I can squeal out one more thing. She died in that tea room of a temple that she was given on December 10th, 1875. This is her death poem. How I hope to pass away while gazing at a round moon in a cloudless sky that shines over lotus flowers in full bloom. How I hope to pass away while gazing at a round moon. Did you see it last night out there? I could pass away right then. In a cloudless sky that shines over lotus flowers in full bloom. So, thank you, and I hope that you might join us for some of the Sangha members from our Sangha here in this room right now that are going to present some art practice. It's from 4 to 6, and hope you will be lit by the lotus moon as we present.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.